Hi, I'm Dara Murray, and welcome back to Rightscast. In this episode, we are joined by Dr. Emily Jones, whose research focuses on post-human feminist approaches to international law. Today, we talk about how these theoretical approaches can be used to better understand issues relating to military technologies and autonomous weapons systems. We talk about the different types of autonomous weapons systems, distinctions between automation and autonomy, the role of humans in deploying these systems, and whether it's appropriate to make a distinction between humans and machines in the first instance. This was a very wide-ranging discussion, and we fell down a few rabbit holes. We discussed autonomous weapon systems from a number of different angles, including what it will mean for global North and global South power dynamics, the role of autonomous weapons in states developing digital surveillance infrastructure, and then we moved on to critiques of human rights and potential tensions between critical approaches and human rights approaches. For me, it was an interesting opportunity to learn more about a framework I knew very little about, and I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed the chat. If you do, please tell a friend or a colleague about Rightscast and give us a follow. So, Emily, welcome.
Hi.
Good, we're off to a good start. So maybe you could start by telling us who you are and introducing yourself.
Yes, so my name is Emily Jones. I'm a lecturer here at the University of Essex in the School of Law and the Human Rights Centre. And I work at kind of the intersection, well, feminist approaches to international law and kind of thinking about post-human approaches within that. And then I kind of am working both on military technologies and then kind of environmental rights at the moment.
And today we're going to talk mainly, I guess, about military technologies. Mm-hmm. And post-humanism, because mm-hmm. that's what got my interest first. I was like, oh, that's an interesting concept.
Yeah.
So maybe we could start off maybe talking a little bit about the different military technologies so people get an understanding of that and then move our way into post-humanism and what it is. And then I guess what it mm-hmm. means for regulation.
Sure.
So what kind of military technologies do you look at?
So I'm primarily focusing on the debate around autonomous weapon systems. So most people will probably have heard of autonomous weapon systems. They're often in the news, this idea of kind of killer robots. You see lots of films about it as mm-hmm. well, right?
Terminator.
Terminator 2. Yes, that Will Smith song. And you know, so there's kind of this idea of pretty often very humanoid looking robots mm-hmm. Is in the media in terms of that are going to sort of become the new soldiers of the future. So I'm kind of looking at the debates around that and some of the myths as well as kind of some of the realities and how we should maybe regulate them potentially.
And so the kind of Terminator vision, you know, this humanoid thing, is that the entire thing we mean by autonomous weapon systems? And is it realistic? Is it possible? You know, how far away are we from it?
Yeah. So obviously the Terminator thing is kind of, it captures imagination and mm-hmm. I can see why groups that are very anti these systems would use that. But in terms of reality, I mean, first we have like definitions of what autonomous weapon mm-hmm. systems even are. That's actually really debated. There's not kind of a set definition. It's generally systems that can select and engage targets by themselves.
Okay. So they could be quite, I guess we think of the Terminator as a replica of a human soldier.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about then in terms of system selecting targets, it's much more limited potentially.
Yeah, and probably doesn't look like a human actually.
Probably a good thing.
Yeah, possibly a good thing. And also if you look at robotic stuff, as you know, most kind of really out there robotics in terms of movement is focusing on like animals and insects, not on humans at all. So much okay. more likely to be kind of based around those non-human animals.
And so what type of autonomous weapon systems are out there at the moment, if any?
So this is also part of the debate that I'm looking at. So autonomous weapons are said to not exist at all yet because, mm-hmm. you know, autonomy is defined very narrowly as kind of almost this artificially intelligent being that can kind of do everything completely by itself once you turn it on. So it's kind of argued that they're not in existence yet, but part of my work is looking at the nuances between autonomy and automation and what that really means.
Okay.
So it's kind of debatable.
And so can you talk us through that then, the distinction between autonomy and automation? And
yeah.
I guess any examples along the way would be useful too, because it's quite a difficult subject to yeah. get your head around.
Yeah, it's quite a weird one, I guess. Yeah. So if we're kind of thinking about autonomy and like autonomy is very, this machine that is completely independent in and of itself, once you turn it on, it can kind of walk around in all terrain, make these decisions. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're a long way off that, obviously. And it's also a kind of debatable whether, you know, states would even want that, because then, you know, it might decide to kind of completely turn against them if it's actually genuinely an artificially intelligent being mm-hmm. or an intelligent being. But if we kind of look at what does that autonomy mean, well, that's kind of assuming that it's this thing that's completely independent, but there are kind of levels towards that. So in terms of thinking about machines making decisions, mm-hmm. which is kind of the core ethical debate here. Yep. Like, people don't want machines to make these decisions, right? If we're looking at that, then actually that's already happening in terms of automation, or what was kind of termed automated. So part of my stuff is around problematizing this distinction between automation and autonomy. So if we think about kind of different systems that exist, we can look, for example, at the Samsung SGR-A1, which was on the border of North and South Korea, been used since sort of around 2008-ish. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for verifying that.
I'm not sure. I'm just nodding.
You're nodding, so it's making me feel better about what I'm saying. Yeah, so basically this system, it can detect whether something is human, non-human animal or matter from up to 4 kilometres away using kind of infrared technology, etc. And then when you get within 10 metres of the system itself, it can command you to like stop. It has voice recognition. Mm-hmm. And it can then make a decision whether to call a commander or fire real or rubber bullets. Someone's supposed to be watching over it all the time. But, you know, to some extent, it is making some of those decisions itself. Mm-hmm. So that kind of problematizes this distinction already, in a sense.
Yeah, that sounds pretty autonomous.
It's never quite released how autonomous it is. You know, it's quite hard mm-hmm. to find out all of the information sometimes. But yeah, pretty autonomous in many ways. It's making these decisions around kind of who is allowed and who isn't, etc.
And why is it important then to break down this distinction between autonomy and automation? Or should we just be considering military technology?
I mean, I guess I focused on the debates around military technology just because there's this idea of delegating, you know, who decides who lives and who dies. And that is a really big ethical question. Of course, you can broaden it out and thinking about autonomy and automation in all areas. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very important in terms of this because it brings in also questions of bias as well a lot. You know, if we're kind of thinking about, so there have been a lot of people that have studied the way in which data is gathered and used in drone mm-hmm. warfare, you know, and this idea that once a file becomes so big, is the person who's flying the drone actually still making a decision whether to target someone or not? So that's really, really important question, because how data is then collected and how the algorithms are kind of programmed, etc., how the data is generally all gathered could have potentially bias implications as well.
So what you're interested in then is to, if I am understanding you correctly, to break down maybe an artificial distinction between autonomy and automation and just really to look at these types of machines used for killing and their interaction with people.
Yeah, basically, because, and this will kind of lead on to the post-humanism bit, but it's really kind of thinking about, yeah, not just seeing autonomy as the thing that we have to worry about, because we're delegating decisions to machines already, and this has been happening for a long time. So actually that ethical question at the centre of the autonomous weapons debate and the reason people want to ban them is actually at play already in terms of the way we're using military technologies.
So in terms of the relationship then between humans and the technology, I guess there are different types of interaction that a human can have in terms of the supervision of the system. Mm-hmm. You know, whether they're, I think, in the loop or on the loop or out of the loop. Could you maybe talk us through that and what it means?
Yeah, so this is kind of the ways in which the human interaction with the military technologies is discussed. So is the human kind of in the loop, so actually kind of making the decision? On the loop, so kind of supervising. So the machine is often doing a lot of what's going on, mm-hmm. but the human is still supposed to be observing. And then out of the loop entirely would be that this kind of idea of an autonomous machine that you turn on and therefore it goes and does its own thing. Yeah, so part of my work is then saying, well, actually all of these things are not so clearly distinct. So even if the human is on the loop, but the machine is making the decisions and it has a kind of enough data to present you with a very strong argument, is a human going to actually stop that? You know, at what point is the machine kind of actually making the decision? And this brings in also human enhancement technologies,
yeah.
I guess.
So I think that's a super interesting element, the kind of the level of deference that's given to an automated decision. But maybe before we get on to that, could you talk us through kind of some examples of an in-the-loop, an on-the-loop, and an out-of-the-loop technology?
Mm-hmm. So I guess in-the-loop is the standard military technologies that we think of. I guess one argument would be made that drone warfare is arguably in the loop because somebody is flying the drone and actually making the decision to target.
So that instance, I guess the technology is a tool that the human is using, just like a gun, except it's clever, more clever.
Except it's a bit more clever,
And more expensive.
Yeah. We've already seen that we can kind of problematize that to some extent, that it's in the loop. But anyway.
On the loop?
Yep. So on the loop would be more... So if you think, for example, like the Patriot Advanced Capability System, the PAC system. So this is basically a system that you can put and it can see incoming missiles and, you know, detect that they're incoming missiles, all kind of small aircraft, and then target them with another missile to basically blow it up before it reaches you. Mm-hmm. So that actually can work completely independently. It can see that there's a missile coming in. It can see that it's a threat. It can actually send a missile to blow up the missile before it hits. But there is a human watching over it who can technically stop that process if they want to. So that would be this kind of on the loop idea.
And I guess that's similar to the Samsung example you gave then on the border with North Korea, in that it's working itself, but there's a human overseeing it, or it will ask a human for authorization, I guess, to engage.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what people would argue. It's, as I said, I'm kind of problematizing that to some extent, because, you know, to what extent would the human be able to stop that, or would they even want to because of the data presented?
But And out of the loop, do we have any out of the loop examples?
So arguably there are no kind of out of the loop examples. This would be this idea of this completely autonomous weapon. Again, like when you start thinking about, you know, what does actually out of the loop, this really creates this idea that the machine is completely other to the human, which is very problematic in a lot of ways. You know, is there any such thing as out of the loop? Because the human would also, I mean, humanity would be making these machines, designing them, programming them.
Deciding to deploy them.
Deciding to deploy them, you know, and all of the kind of issues around responsibility there as well.
Interesting. Yeah. So then in terms of, I think one of the things I found really interesting is the level of interaction between the human and the system. It's something we look a lot at in terms of, say, the criminal justice system. You know, if you have a risk assessment of an individual, it makes a recommendation. This person is at high risk of committing a violent crime or at low risk. Ideally, I suppose a judge or a parole officer is supposed to take that into account. But the worry is that instead of just taking it into account and performing, you know, effective human supervision, that they will defer to the system. And I guess one of the things that we're thinking is that it's going to be really difficult to explain yourself. You know, if you decide, look, this person isn't, in my experience, isn't at high risk of committing a violent crime. The algorithm suggests that they are. You overrule it, and then they go and commit a violent crime and somebody dies. It becomes very hard. And so the risk to the person making the decision is very high. And I suppose that's really potentially accentuated in a military context where it is most definitely a life and death issue. I'm not aware of too much research that really definitively gives an answer to that. Like, it's a problem, but maybe you could talk us through how you approach it.
There's so much there. So I guess in terms of kind of this area, one of the problems is also then thinking about who would actually be responsible. So if we kind of got a machine that's making these decisions, potentially you might have a human on the loop. Maybe you won't if it's an autonomous weapon system. It's very much, who can you hold responsible in that situation? Is it the kind of military commander? Is it the person who made the machine, the person who programmed it? You know, the person who's potentially on the loop, the person who's like working alongside the machine, if there is an artificially intelligent being. So it's kind of thinking about all of those issues. And I don't think that there is a clear answer. I think that's one of the really big problems that we're going to face. And it could really lead to kind of militaries just saying, well, we didn't do it, the machine did it. And, you know, what are the risks with that? Do we put the machine itself on trial? Is that something we actually want? Yeah, I think it's a big issue.
It also seems like it's a really difficult thing to understand effectively in the sense that there's clearly a risk. You know, I think it's a very human risk. You know, you don't want to get it wrong and have to try and explain yourself. People assume computers are smarter than them. I do. They are a lot of the time. But obviously they're problematic. So it seems like it's a really important issue to address, but one that's very uncertain in terms of how we approach it.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I don't think that there is a kind of, there are a lot of people working around, you know, how could we possibly address this in international criminal law or in tort law, but like really not clear.
I suppose one of the added complexities in a military context is going to be, well, a couple of different things. One of them is probably fatigue. You know, you see that a lot in traditional military operations when people's judgment is called into question. The example I'm thinking of is the Kunduz attack on the MSF unit there, where in the report, one of the things they said is that soldiers had been up for 3 days fighting. You know, they were tired. Their decision-making wasn't at its best. But the other, I suppose, is the speed. You know, if you're under attack, you have to make a decision very quickly. And so the ability to keep up with a computer is probably going to be difficult.
Definitely. Yeah. And this is kind of when we're thinking more about the human and the machine working together, I guess. I mean, but these are then some of the debates as to why people argue, particularly kind of roboticists or certain people arguing why we should have autonomous weapons, because they won't get tired. You know, they will make unemotional decisions. Some people argue that you can kind of program international humanitarian law into them very easily. Of course, that assumes that IHL is a very binary system, which is very problematic. But yeah, there's all of these kind of issues.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I think intuitively, the idea of a Terminator-style autonomous weapon system is very scary.
Mm.
But broken down into discrete applications, I think that's where I can see the benefit in some examples. So, you know, say a system that is more discrete, is trained to recognize a particular type of tank,
mm-hmm.
and to, you know, so say it's a Cold War scenario, it's mm-hmm. a Russian tank, you
yep.
know, they're trained to recognize a T-32, that's all they do.
Yep.
They blow up those, it's autonomous,
mm-hmm.
it functions, but it's very limited. You mm-hmm. know, there I could see the appeal, I guess.
Mm. I mean, I guess it's also whether we trust machines to make these decisions. And some of them are very hard. You know, how can soldiers already mess up all the time, mm-hmm. who's a civilian and who's a combatant? So is that something? And then what happens if a machine actually makes that decision? There's something kind of quite morally difficult as well. I mean, if that's your family member and then it's not even a human who made a mistake, it's a machine. There's something about that that I think is quite scary.
Yeah, I guess that, so that's kind of where I approach it, I think, is that there's two elements. There's the legal element and then the ethical element.
Yeah.
I think for the legal element, approaching autonomous weapon systems there, I think my approach, I guess, is to break them down.
Mm.
So what are you trying to do and can you do it?
Mm-hmm.
So with the tank example, you know, can you develop machine learning or AI software to a sufficient degree of reliability that it'll identify the tank?
Yeah.
And that's where I guess the designer, the developer's responsibility comes in terms of mm-hmm. how good their product is.
Yeah.
And then potentially you can deploy it. Obviously, to get to the point of distinguishing between a combatant and a civilian is going to be mm-hmm. way more difficult and
yeah.
is maybe, you know, much further ahead.
For sure.
But that doesn't address the ethical issue.
No, it doesn't. And it doesn't address kind of some of the wider political issues as well. So one thing that I think is really interesting in terms of the autonomous weapon debate is that, you know, the states that have actually called for a ban are all from the global south.
Mm-hmm.
So that already tells you who's going to be making this technology and who is frightened of it being used against. So, you know, even if you could make these kind of machines that can target very specific things, does that just in the end just create this global north kind of UK, US, France, etc. with having this hyper advanced technology? And what does that then do for global power relations?
Is that it really, though, a continuation of kind of current debates? You know, already those countries have far more sophisticated armies or militaries than mm-hmm. nearly everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So that power imbalance exists?
Yeah, definitely. But then I guess we have kind of seen moments in kind of contemporary wars where people have been able to still get around that. So through using certain tactics, and it's like as the technology becomes more and more advanced, that may become more and more impossible.
Yeah, so this is something I find really interesting because I think despite, you know, the huge discrepancy in military capabilities, in most recent conflicts that I can think of anyway, it hasn't been that decisive.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Syria being an exception in terms of the air power, but something like, you know, Vietnam, the Viet Cong beat the French, and then the Americans, the insurgency in Iraq, in Afghanistan before that. Do you think that these types of technologies will make that more difficult? Like, I'm really on the fence about it. I was watching a movie the other day about the Troubles.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had, you know, IRA men walking around the streets of Northern Ireland. And I was just thinking, oh, they could do that then. Now you'd have phones, you'd have CCTV, you know, their ability to operate in an urban environment is already much more difficult.
Yeah.
So do you think it will make a fundamental shift, I guess, in the actual power relation, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you. I'm slightly on the fence in some ways. I guess we just have to see what is actually developed. I think eventually at some point there could be a tipping point where it becomes so advanced that it's just kind of, you know, almost impossible to be able to fight back. But I don't think we're there yet. And I guess this is kind of a big concern. And this is maybe why states, particularly in the global south, have been kind of more on board with this idea of banning, because at what point does it become the tipping point that it's just kind of, you know, really obvious? I mean, obviously colonialism has continued into the present day anyway, but kind of really obvious military intervention style colonialism through technology.
So this is off the top of my head a little bit, but I wonder, is part of the imbalance of power issue linked to not just autonomous weapon systems or these really advanced military technologies on their own, but how they link to other developments in state power? So in terms of, say, a state's surveillance capacity and the ability to subject potentially its own population or other populations to AI analysis. So there you have autonomous weapon systems existing in a new ecosystem whereby the balance of power between the state and citizens is already fundamentally changed because of the level of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before, and I suppose that's the example I was thinking of with the IRA in the north, the state just didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
Here, with the increase in kind of digitalization, the state has a much more in-depth and more granular knowledge of what everybody does. So I wonder if autonomous weapons then kind of sit into that. That's where the power shift might come.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. You know, and I think that's, again, important to remember. There's often these debates often don't get brought together so much. And I think that's a big problem. You know, autonomous weapons, the debates around this, it's very much not thinking about that wider kind of civil use of these technologies. But actually, yeah, if you kind of did bring that together and you have all of this knowledge, and then you're given, and then the autonomous weapons also have that knowledge from the state, that's really scary. Mm.
I think one of the interesting elements then is that in some ways that breaks down the north-south divide, because we see a lot of countries in the south really pushing for not necessarily autonomous weapon systems, but for really increased surveillance systems. You know, so India is a case on point, I think. So I'm not sure how that kind of ties into the broader narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of really interesting. I mean, again, you kind of need to look at like who is calling for this within the global south. So it's definitely not all states in the global south. I mean, I think India is a great example, but we have to bear in mind that they have a particular very conservative government actually in India, Hindu right-wing government as well. So I think that, you know, that kind of plays into it. China also obviously being another big one, but, you know, a very sort of particular state-sponsored version of what the state should be. So I don't think it's necessarily, if you kind of look at other states in the global south, this isn't necessarily what they're calling for either. So I think you have to have that nuance.
Is there a north-south distinction in terms of countries calling for, say, a ban on autonomous, or skeptical of autonomous weapon systems, or is there correlation? You know, is there an alliance there?
Yeah, so actually the states that have kind of actually said that they're for a ban at all from the global south. Of course, there are kind of some states that are a bit less militaristic that are kind of a bit more balanced on this. But then you obviously have the great military powers that are basically just like, no, this will be a good thing, or we don't want a ban because it's not nuanced enough or whatever. Yeah, so you can kind of see that split in that
sense. Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
And so bringing us back a little bit, I guess, then to autonomous weapon systems specifically and the level of interaction between humans and the system. I guess that brings us along to post-humanism, which I know very little about.
So you would like me to explain?
I would really like that, yeah.
So post-humanism for me, and particularly kind of post-human feminism, because I situate all my work within a feminist ethical or methodological framework, post-humanism for me sits between the convergence of post-anthropocentrism and post-humanism.
Okay,
so
you lost me. Yeah.
Describe that. I'm good. Don't worry, it will totally make sense. So if we're thinking about humanism as a kind of concept that is very much structured Western political thought, or kind of dominant legal thought as well, it is kind of really centered a particular human subject. So the white, straight, male, middle class, you know, normally sort of middle-aged subject. You know, but like feminist legal studies has long shown that to be a kind of problem, and the ways in which the law very much centers that subject.
Yep.
So it's kind of first trying to dismantle the hierarchies there. But then it also brings this post-anthropocentrism argument in. So arguing that, you know, in the kind of Anthropocene, this has been the moment in which humanity has really kind of seen itself in control of the environment and of nature, and challenging that idea that humanity should be in charge of that. So kind of decentering the idea that the human is in hierarchy over non-human animals, nature, and also machines as well, that we inherently dominate machines. So challenging all of those different kind of hierarchies.
Interesting. So I see the first part of that, I guess. It makes a lot of sense just in terms of a more balanced ecosystem. But I would never have thought of machines being a part of that. I would always have seen them in a different way to the environment, our animals, our, you know, as part of, I guess, the ecosystem. So maybe you could explain.
The machine part?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is kind of actually a lot of Donna Haraway's early work, where she really looks at kind of, this kind of arrogance that humans are in dominance over machines, and the ways in which, for feminists in particular, actually those kind of strange mixing between the machine and the human, which is already happening. We're all cyborgs in a way. You know, we're all using our mobile phones, technology as part of, or many of us, particularly in the global north. You know, she looks at the ways in which actually that kind of merging and that challenging of the sort of idea that the human is dominant over everything is really, really important and could have very positive impacts from a kind of feminist perspective.
the bit I find or I'm struggling with a little, I guess, is the idea of domination. I obviously agree with the idea of domination in general. Well, not, I don't agree with you. You know,
you don't
what I
like
mean.
It.
But it's the domination over something inanimate. So how is a computer different from a spade? Do you know, like, because I can see domination over nature or domination over animals as living organisms, part of our ecosystem, I suppose. But how does that, where does the machine fits in? You know, are we giving machines too much agency?
I mean, this also kind of brings in the question of matter, right? So feminist new materialism or new materialist perspective, they are called so many different things right now. There's a lot of terms. But anyway, we'll just go with that one. Kind of also challenges the idea that we've kind of always focused on kind of human subjectivity, but how matter is also very much alive and has a subjectivity, you know, and just because it's not something that we can necessarily read because we are not able to, it doesn't mean that that doesn't exist. So kind of also challenging that ontological, really bringing in matter into the understanding of being, if that makes sense, sort of.
To a degree, I haven't had enough coffee this morning, so the brain is spinning a bit slowly. Maybe like an example would help. So how does it apply then, say, to autonomous weapon systems? How does this analysis apply and how does it then inform how we view AWS?
So I'm going to kind of give a couple of examples leading to AWS just because I think it might make a bit more sense, hopefully.
Take it slowly.
So if we're thinking about you know, the fact that matter in itself has the ability to be a subject, this could be seen in kind of claims for trees to have legal standing, for example. So, you know, why should it just be humans? If we're actually accepting that the environment is as important as humans, then trees or the environment or rivers should have legal standing. So that's kind of one way of looking at it. And you could also start thinking about potentially AI as having legal standing or legal subjectivity. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect, and the kind of, again, going back to what Donna Haraway says, this kind of connection between the human machine and the cyborg. This is really important for autonomous weapons because it brings in this debate around what is autonomy again. If humans have always seen themselves in domination over machines, of course we see the autonomous weapons as this machinic other thing that we're frightened of. But if we kind of see our role and our connection with machines, that allows us to see all of these technologies that, you know, we're already kind of delegating life-death decisions to, but we're also part of. And it allows us also to take responsibility for the technology ourselves more, rather than just we ban it because it's frightening. Actually, we're making it.
I think one of the things I find interesting about it is that, well, it's a very different way of thinking to how I normally approach things, but that some of the results are quite similar in terms of the human rights law approach to AWS or AI in general, say. One of the things that we've been trying to figure out really is that relationship between the human and the machine, and in different terms, I guess, but also to get away from the idea of the machine or AI as something entirely distinct with an agency of its own that it can be responsible. So what we're trying to do in a different way, I guess, is to break down that distinction between the human and machine just from a slightly different perspective, to say that, you know, there is always responsibility. Some of the debate is focused on, you know, whether, you know, machines should be put on trial or anything like that. I think I don't get it, to be honest. It seems like maybe some days in a long-term future. But at the moment, there's always a human involved, you know, and it's either as the designer, you know, whether they've developed a good system, like going back to the, what we were talking about earlier, you know, kind of is it capable of recognizing a tank or a fighter or a civilian? You know, if they don't do that effectively and to a degree of reliability, then they should be responsible. Equally, the commander deploys it in a particular context. So I guess that's a long-winded way, I suppose, of finding it interesting that there seems to be a really close relationship, maybe not in terms of approach, but in terms of effects between what I understand is your a post-human feminist approach to it and a human rights law approach. I don't know if you've thought about it before.
A little bit, to some extent. I guess there are definitely a lot of similarities there in the sense of like trying to find some kind of human rights or socially just way of understanding these technologies and their role in society. I guess there are kind of two parts of the feminist post-humanism in the way that I'm using it that I think would maybe be a little bit different. So the first one would be, well, I suppose the first one would be thinking about the ways in which we need to also look beyond the law. So a lot of feminist post-human theory is very much also looking at kind of, it's not necessarily about law. Actually, not many people have brought this to the law. So to what extent do the people who are designing and making the technology also have a responsibility? So post-human feminism also really calls for kind of feminists to be designing and making this technology and having an active role. So I guess that's kind of one thing that human rights law doesn't necessarily focus on, just because that's not the focus per se. The other thing that a kind of post-human approach would critique would be the kind of liberal humanism of human rights, which, you know, doesn't render human rights useless, but human rights have been very much used, as kind of scholars like Ratna Kapoor have shown, as a kind of governance tool in many ways. So, you know, who is included and excluded within human rights is actually a very kind of core question when you think about it from a perspective of gender, from race, etc. So there also the need to use human rights as much as you can, but also to go further beyond that. You know, thinking about kind of social justice beyond human rights is really important. A lot of the time, struggles get contained within human rights because it's such a dominant discourse now. And then things get left out.
What does post-humanism mean for AWS then? How does it apply to it? So you say how it should take into account maybe who's involved, or a post-humanist feminist, and who's involved in the design of the systems. How would it play out in practice? Would it result in the systems being banned? Would it result in a slightly different looking system, or the system deployed in a different way? What does it mean?
Yeah, because such a lawyer asking me for solutions. Anyway, I'm getting used to it. It's fine. Yeah. I mean, I guess post-humanism is the way that I'm using it is challenging the humanist assumptions at the centre of the debates around autonomous weapon systems. So this humanist assumption that we are going to be completely other to that machine without seeing all of these interconnections that are already happening. So actually saying, you know, even if you ban autonomous weapon systems, states are going to define that so narrowly that it basically is not going to ban anything at all anyway.
Sure.
And you're not dealing with the actual kind of ethical question of delegating decisions. So in terms of what we can do about that, I have some ideas, but they're all problematic in their own way as well. But I think part of the problem with this kind of ban or allow framework that we have in international law, you know, we've banned blinding lasers, for example, etc., is that, you know, it can very much be focused on, okay, so you've banned that very specific thing within those definitional terms, but anything outside of that is allowed.
Sure.
So, you know, ban blinding lasers, but there are states now developing just full-on lasers. So there's kind of a limitation to that. So the need for more of a kind of ethical balancing system more broadly that kind of looks at the various different issues and tries to do that. You could say this happens in terms of legal review of weapons under Article 36, but that is ultimately states doing that by themselves. They don't really tell you exactly why they decided things.
And don't particularly take an ethical approach necessarily, but more of a, you know, unnecessary suffering.
Yeah, an IHL approach. So So kind of maybe the need for a more independent body that actually does do this ethical balancing. Of course, we need states to consent to that, and they're probably not going to, but...
Of course, but I guess you're ultimately going to come with the question then of whether delegating killing to a machine is ethical or not. And I'm not sure where kind of this approach leads us, you know, because it seems that if we consider there to be a correlate or a close relationship between human and decision making, then we're not delegating at all. And so in some ways, it doesn't pose a new problem at all, because we've been killing for ages. Obviously, that's problematic in itself, but...
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of actually one of the problems for me in working in this topic. So... In a sense, I kind of started out with feminist post-human theory and then was like, oh, but wait, I'm also an international lawyer. And like, this is really scary. And I actually wanted to use this example because feminist post-humanism is pretty positive about technology. It's, you know, saying this has the potential to transform these different hierarchies that I outlined before. But I guess the problem then of bringing post-human feminism to the military technologies debate is that ultimately, in some way, could you just be justifying killing and war? And the feminist international lawyer in me is very much about disarmament entirely, that we just should not have weapons. And that would be my ultimate goal. So that's a massive contradiction in how I feel about this topic and actually what I want to do with it. And I don't really know.
It's interesting, though, Bill. I think it's a contradiction in the law. Well, I mean, a contradiction in the law is the wrong way to approach it. But I think a lot of people would like to see war gone, but at the same time understand or take the approach that if it's going to continue, then it should be regulated.
Yeah.
So it's an unusual situation, but not necessarily, I guess, a contradiction, because the two things can be true at the same time.
The two things can definitely be true at the same time. But then, like, you know, one of the critiques of IHL would be that by saying that you can have war in a more ethical way and providing the legal framework for that, you're actually justifying war. Mm-hmm. So there are contradictions that kind of sit within contradictions that can be held at the same time, but also can't. And that's hard.
This is something I find really interesting, because I would never see it as justifying war, but as acknowledging war.
I mean, you could also see this as the tension between human rights and critical approaches in many ways, right? Human rights is trying to potentially address through courts or whatever the kind of immediate situation, and critical approach is saying, yeah, but wait, what is not seen by that? Mm-hmm. But I mean, I agree. I think it's not, well, you can have those multiple strategies across each other at the same time. I think it's important to just note that there are multiple strategies and that you are maybe being contradictory in taking one particular approach and being aware of that. And I think the problem comes when people are not aware of that.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that, I think.
Yeah, we agree. Weird.
See, well, I don't see...
I'm going to make you a critic.
I don't see human rights and critical theory or anything else as oppositional.
No. Yeah.
I guess I see human rights as a framework to hopefully deliver something. And anything that contributes to a better understanding is valuable. And no matter where it comes from, you know, so it's always good to have different voices, isn't it? And to try and understand the world in a more, well, in a better way.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think it's just that there becomes, I mean, as you know, there can be some kind of hostility between crits and human rights lawyers. And I think that's the problem, actually, because it's, you know, just because critical theorists might be saying that human rights are not enough and we need to look beyond human rights, that's not necessarily that we should get rid of that. It's that we need to kind of work across all of those strategies and both be aware. So, you know, human rights might come from a particular, arguably Western perspective. This is an argument that is made by many people, but that doesn't necessarily render them completely, you know, invaluable. But it just means that you should have that kind of perspective of colonization when you're thinking about your human rights application and your advocacy, so that you also don't perform the same colonizing move through your human rights work. It's kind of holding that together at the same time. And I think that that's really important.
Yeah, it is. And I think I wonder, are some of the difficulties tied to, say, some of the things we see in interdisciplinary work in general? You know, I think everybody, or most people now, acknowledges that interdisciplinary approaches are really key, because there's no one lens through to view the world. The world is complex, it's messy, we need to take into account different issues. But some of the things I've encountered, I guess, working on interdisciplinary projects, is that people use different languages.
Yeah, completely.
And are not necessarily fully aware of everybody else. So I guess, and maybe this is like the inherent optimist in me, I don't think that necessarily there has to be distinctions, but I do think that very often people make assumptions about the, and everyone's guilty of this, like make assumptions about what other people or other approaches think or what they are. And there's a lack of knowledge and engagement. So like, say, with the critiques of human rights, I think a lot of them I would put in the uncritical critics camp, in that they're not critiquing their own critique sufficiently. But I wonder, is it just, how do we get past that, I guess? Because a lot of it is knowledge, it's engagement, it's openness. But it's also really difficult to stay on top of all these different issues.
It is really difficult. Yeah, but I do think it's really important to have debates across all of these different positions, and also, like, you know, across disciplines. And I think this kind of brings it back to technology as well. Like, a lot of these debates are actually happening in kind of sciences and technology and computer science, but in very different language.
Yes, very different.
Yeah. So I think, like, we really need to start having those debates across disciplines much more. I actually think the kind of disciplines that we have are completely useless in the contemporary moment that we're in. So I think we need to start rethinking those.
Yeah, I guess a more of acknowledgement of the limitations of our disciplines and a willingness to engage with. Well, I guess that's the heart of interdisciplinary work, isn't it? It's an acknowledgement that your discipline doesn't have all the answers, so you have to work with somebody else to get there.
Definitely. But also centering voices that tend to be peripheral otherwise as well, I think, is really important. So really centering, you know, kind of voices from the global south, feminist perspectives, etc., because otherwise those things do get left out, and that's really problematic for many reasons. It becomes, again, about inclusion and exclusion. So it's not just interdisciplinarity, law works with science. Like, what about bringing in, you know, people who are otherwise rendered peripheral?
Thank you for listening to this episode of Rightscast from the University of Essex Human Rights Centre. You can subscribe and find more of our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow the Human Rights Centre blog at hrcessex.wordpress.com. We'll be back soon with more regular episodes.